Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Friday, and the impeachment trial is wrapping up. Even as we're speaking, the Trump lawyers are blaming everything on Black Lives Matter and Antifa, and there's a lot of whataboutisms. We may get to that a little bit later. Hey, before we get started with our special guest, Peter Hamby, I want to thank all the listeners of the podcast. Sometime yesterday, we passed 33 million downloads. We really, really appreciate this. And again, want to encourage you, if you have not yet done so, to join Bulwark Plus. This is not the only podcast, by the way, at the Bulwark. We have the Next Level podcast. We have the Secret podcast. We have Mona Charon's outstanding Beg to Differ. And of course, if you sign up, you get the Morning Shots newsletter and the Triad newsletter. As we start off today, though, we have some breaking news. We have some audio from, of all people, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. Let's go to the audio.
Let it be said that any president who cheats our institutions shall be impeached.
Because impeachment is not about punishment. Impeachment is about cleansing the office. Impeachment is about restoring honor and integrity to the office. When you start using your office and you're acting in a way that hurts people, you've committed a high crime.
Oh shit, that's the wrong soundbite, isn't it? That's the old Lindsey Graham. That's from the 1990s. The new Lindsey Graham is the one who is actually huddling with the Trump lawyers. He and Mike Lee and Ted Cruz, all of them jurors who took the oath to be completely objective about all of this, were actually meeting behind closed doors to help the Trump lawyers strategize. This is actually Lindsey Graham from last night. Yeah, see you tomorrow. Huh? Oh, jeez. All right, Peter Hamby. Hey, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it very much. Peter Hamby is the host of Snapchat's Good Luck America, which we need a good deal of, and a contributing writer for Vanity Fair. So good morning. How are you?
I'm good, Charlie. Greetings from California.
I have a list of all sorts of things on my pad here, and to each one of them, my question is, what is wrong with people? But let's start with before we get started with the impeachment trial, because obviously that's what everybody wants to talk about, and I want to talk about your piece where you compare Donald Trump to Sarah Palin, because I want you to convince me that you're right about that, and we can also talk about Mario Cuomo and a variety of other things.
And if
I actually start day drinking, we can talk about the Lincoln Project. But that's only if I start day drinking by the end of the podcast. So you used to work in South Carolina, and you know Nikki Haley pretty well, right?
Yeah, I actually met Nikki Haley when she was a state legislator.
Way back
in 2007, when I was living down there for CNN covering that presidential primary. Yeah, I've known her for a while.
So there is this absolutely fantastic piece in Politico by Tim Alberta, long deep dive into Nikki Haley that describes her background and the way she's gone back and forth with Donald Trump, and then includes what appears to be some comments breaking with Donald Trump, where she says it was really a mistake. And let me see if I can scroll down to exactly what she said, whether she's really the prodigal daughter these days. This is the way The Hill describes it: stunning remarks breaking with Trump, believes that Trump let us down. We need to acknowledge he let us down. He went down a path he shouldn't have, and we shouldn't have followed him. We shouldn't have listened to him, and we can't let that ever happen again. So your thoughts, you know, are a lot better than me. I say, I'm tempted to be all cynical and snarky and say, God, we've been here before. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago she was saying, oh, give him a break. So Give me your take on Nikki Haley and Nikki Haley's latest iteration of being critical of Trump.
The latest iteration is the key phrase there. I mean, I texted a couple South Carolina Republicans after the Capitol Hill riot and said, I feel like if Nikki runs in 2024, she's just, again, just caught between a rock and a hard place. Like, I don't, you know, we'll talk more about my ideas about comparing Trump and Sarah Palin and his, you know, personality fading in the next few years. But, you know, currently you have a Josh Hawley side of the party and a a smaller Mitt Romney, Liz Cheney side of the party. And, you know, I don't even know if you still call yourself an actual Republican.
No.
That side of the party that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Where's Nikki Haley's lane here? I mean, her fellow South Carolinian, who we just heard, Lindsey Graham, has baffled and befuddled and confounded liberals and people in the media for going all in on Donald Trump. However, this is one thing I've learned about Lindsey Graham from living in South Carolina. His antenna is always, 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 especially when it's around an election, near the base of South Carolina. And obviously, Lindsey Graham has flouted Republicans in the past on immigration, on, you know, military things, like he's crossed paths with like the libertarians in his state. But he knows where South Carolina Republicans are. And so he feels way more aligned with them than Nikki Haley does right now, if you're thinking about a presidential primary in a few years. So, you know, she has really gone from, you know, Bulwark listeners probably know this and remember this well, but endorsing Marco Rubio in 2016 before the South Carolina Republican primary, when she was the kingmaker, trashing Donald Trump at the time, to, you know, in a rather tortured way, then showing up on the floor of the Republican convention in Cleveland, applauding Donald Trump, to becoming his UN ambassador, right? She followed the path of a lot of conventional Republicans at the time, but then leaving, and like, she's always, in other words, just tried to maintain a little bit of a safe distance from Donald Trump while, you know, at times being critical and not being critical. And this sounds again like, what are you doing? Like, she just kind of goes where the wind blows a lot of times. And she has had very good personal political instincts, but she listens to herself. She's not like Josh Hawley, who's surrounded by a bunch of like advisors telling him how to be a conservative. Like, she talks to John Lerner, her pollster, and not that many other people, and does her own thing. So that separates her a little bit from some other politicians, I think.
That's consistent with the portrait that Tim Alberta, you know, paints, that he writes that she's definitely running in 2024. She's obviously got very set ambitions to do that, has not yet figured out this whole question of the lane, doesn't have, you know, a firm, you know, ideological compass necessarily. But I guess the problem that we've seen with her is that every time she kind of, you know, sticks her head up above the foxhole and gets incoming fire, there's blowback, there's backlash. She backs off within 24 hours. So there's an expiration date on all of this, which again, is probably going to leave her sitting out on an island somewhere.
Yeah, I think that's true. And look, I do want to say, like, the idea of lanes in primaries, like Donald Trump kind of broke that. Bernie Sanders kind of broke that. Like, it's definitely a little bit of a media construct. But, you know, I tend to think that Donald Trump will still be influential. But very good politicians bend their electorates to their will with a message that is compelling and acknowledge that times change. So, like, perhaps to her credit, if she continues to say, put distance between herself and Donald Trump and say, I'm going to be a slightly different kind of Republican, follow me. Like, cool, do that. But that the issue is, she hasn't really, over the last 4 years, demonstrated that she's willing to, you know, swim in a single direction. So, maybe she'll continue down this path and be a, not necessarily like a never Trump kind of Republican, but like, hey, we need to put him in the rear view. Here's what I believe. I don't believe in riots. I don't believe in like killing people on Capitol Hill, you know, but here's what I do believe, and here's my experience and my vision, and maybe that will stick. And I'm open to that. But again, like, she definitely has the capacity to zigzag.
Yeah, one line from this Politico article: Corey Lewandowski, the former Trump campaign manager, has been overheard advising South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to run against Haley as the hotter, Trumpier, real American governor. Oh God, this is an indication. Well, in the story though, the first, I would say, maybe a third of it is not at all flattering to her, because it's Tim Alberta talking with her after the election, and she's rationalizing not pushing back on Donald Trump's lies about losing the election by saying that he believes this. That because Donald Trump believes his lies, they're not really lies, and she can't do anything about it. It's very interesting. It's that whole Donald Trump as toddler, that somehow that if he thinks that the sky is purple, then to him the sky is purple, and there's nothing morally wrong with him saying that the sky is purple and trying to convince people that the sky is purple. And it's quite frankly, it's not a great look for Haley.
Yeah. I don't think it is either. Real quick though, Charlie, what do you think about Kristi Noem running as the hotter Trumpier Real American governor? Because you live in Real America.
We're not South Dakota here. I don't know whether anybody even knows her here, but it is interesting that's the way these people think. These people think about it. I don't know. I would think if so many people weren't dying in South Dakota of coronavirus, it would be more plausible. But I don't know. But it is interesting that is the formula, right? That. Hotter, Trumpier, real American governor.
Yeah, so. I mean, the Trump people definitely believe in the idea of celebrities having power, and I do too. I mean, I live and breathe social media every day. Understand that identity can be more important than substance.
Well, that's right. It is,
unfortunately. And Noem, I. You've seen this, like on Fox News, like she would run these tourism commercials for South Dakota constantly, not political. It'd be like, but it looked like a political ad. There'd be these gleaming shots of like a bucolic, South Dakota prairie. And then it would end with Kristi Noem being like, I'm South Dakota's Kristi Noem, like, come see us. And like, mm-hmm. It's like a, if you're just a grandma watching Fox News, like all of a sudden, Kristi Noem,
that's right.
Name ID that's like, based on nothing other than, South Dakota looks nice and she looks nice. And, she's not.
I would never underestimate that. I think this is the one thing that I think political wonks tend to undervalue, which is, what are those voters seeing on television every night in their living room? And looks matter. And I'm sorry. And also identity and celebrity do matter a lot more than policy substance. I mean, the era in which candidates prepare for running by sitting in a room with a bunch of PhDs working on policy white papers, that's gone. Okay, so I want to talk about, speaking of which, we're gonna dial back to this because we're gonna come back to Sarah Palin, who feels like sort of patient zero in all of this. But let's just talk about impeachment for a moment. Yesterday, it's been a short trial. I think we know what the result is going to be. I was very impressed with the Democrats. I was skeptical about the trial. I thought they did a very powerful job. And then they wrapped up yesterday. And as I wrote in my newsletter today, I thought they really went to the heart of what this trial is about. It's not about removal. It's about disqualification, and it's about deterrence. And Jamie Raskin, I think, honed in, zeroed in right on that point right here. Let's play that soundbite from Jamie Raskin.
My dear colleagues, is there any political leader in this room who believes that if he is ever allowed by the Senate to get back into the Oval Office, Donald Trump would stop inciting violence to get his way? Would you bet the lives of more police officers on that? Would you bet the safety of your family on that? Would you bet the future of your democracy on that? President Trump declared his conduct totally appropriate. So, if he gets back into office and it happens again, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
So, Peter Hamby, your thoughts about the impeachment trial the last 3 days?
There are times when I am grateful that I worked at CNN for 10 years. I think that's when I first talked to you, maybe during a Scott Walker thing back in the day. But
yeah.
I get to watch things like this a little bit more as a civilian because I'm not like a day-to-day beat reporter in DC. And I found it incredibly compelling in a way that I did not the original impeachment trial for a few reasons. One, the subject at hand is emotionally much more cut and dry. It just packs a punch, right? Like we know, everyone knows what happened. And everyone, I give them great credit for showing a video in the, on the first day. Like that just, that felt to me like I tweeted like, oh, we're like, they're showing a sizzle reel at the impeachment trial. But in the social media era, like video is the coin of the realm. And we saw this really haunting on the ground footage that, you know, even on its own, if the presentation ended that day, would be powerful. Raskin is really talented. And that is the consensus from all of the Democrats that I talked to. I don't mean to diminish him in this way, but like as a performer.
Yes, no, right.
Way more than Adam Schiff, who felt very much like a sort of, you know, boring, dry, like district attorney, you know, or like a tax lawyer. Like Raskin, you know, who, as we know, like recently lost his son and choked up talking about his family, but it didn't seem, it just felt very real. And you can see like
riveting.
Yeah. And like, I guess Pelosi makes a designation as to who's going to be the impeachment managers, but like, you can tell, like he was probably fired up and Pelosi was like, go get it, man. I can see you really care about this. So the presentation has been scrupulous. The evidence has been really moving. I think that any rational person watching that would have to say that if Donald Trump did not exist, the Capitol Hill riot would not have happened and five people would be alive today. I also don't like saying this. I think Republicans, by relying on the excuse that Trump can't be, you know, convicted out of office, it just gives them a convenient excuse to not pay attention to that.
Sure.
You know, the idea of incitement as a strict, letter of the law, like, did Donald Trump say go to the Capitol and break in? Like, no. And that's the sort of like loophole that Republicans are going to lean on, right? In addition to saying you can't convict.
Yeah. If you want to find an excuse not to do it, you will be able to find an excuse. You will say, well, he said these words, you know, in that word salad that he spoke, he said the words peaceful. He didn't actually say break down the windows. Right. He's already out of office. There's enough of a fig leaf if you want to dodge the up or down vote on his conduct, which of course they all do. Right. I mean, they all understand what happens here. I mean, there's really not that much of a surprise. And I thought that was part of the strength of the House, that they didn't just focus on January 6th. They just talked about the entire context of the lie and the stoking of the anger and the building of it and his ties with these people and how he knew it. And then, of course, the really deadly stuff, the fact his failure to respond, his dereliction of duty when it was ongoing. It's compelling, but there's enough wiggle room. Yep. That if people don't want to draw a line, they won't draw a line.
Yeah. And you have to wonder if, you know, I know that I don't know how this would ever happen in the Senate, if there was some sort of secret ballot in the way there was with the Liz Cheney leadership vote, like what the actual outcome would be. You know, there are certainly people like your pal in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson, who are like true believers now, who will probably vote to acquit either way. But you have to think there's at least, you know, other than this five or six public votes for a conviction, there's right. Got to be like 10 more in there somewhere who are just afraid to vote.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, you know, but yeah, there is that group of about 10 of the true believers. And unfortunately, Ron John from Wisconsin has become one of the true believers. I mean, he's there with Tommy Tuberville.
Yeah. But like Richard Shelby, also, you know, another Alabama guy, like, what does he really think? Come on. Like, you, like, he's retiring, you know, you are a like just lifelong senator. Like, you don't actually think this way, do you, man? Those are the types that I'm curious about.
Well, they just want it to go away. I mean, that's what they're thinking. They're thinking, look, the easy vote is to vote not guilty and then just hope that he fades away.
Well, there's that. And they can vote not guilty and say, as we mentioned, on either the incitement article or you can't convict a former president, but then turn around when asked about it, maybe down the road. I hate what Donald Trump did. I'm glad he's gone, but I didn't think there was grounds to X, Y, Z. Like, that's, it's just a very convenient political strategy. for them.
Okay, which then raises the question about whether this changes anything. And I think your point about the fact that they, this time around, they understand that it is a performance. They understand that there's two juries, that they're talking to the jury of the Senate, which is rigged and fixed, and they're not going to win. But there's also the jury of public opinion out there. And I have to say, look, you know how hard it is to, I said this on the podcast the other day. These guys must have had some help putting this presentation together, because as you know, standing up there and making hours and hours and hours of presentation and then skillfully using little, you know, sound bites and bites of video, that just doesn't happen. I mean, somebody scripted this out with a great deal of skill.
Yeah. I don't have great faith, one, that senators and members of Congress are good performers and entertainers, which is a very
not, right?
They're absolutely not. And the fact that they were like, everyone is on message, no one like went off on like tangents, and they really have leaned into using video on the floor of the Senate.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, radical. Like that is something that they don't usually do. Like usually it's like, here's a chart, here's my like usual like, you know, a hobby horse from back home. But everything has been, it's almost like they hired the people who did Biden's digital convention, which was very
right,
and got them to produce it. It's really been a show.
Okay. I'm glad you said that, because I really did think the same thing, that this thing is like way above their normal skill set. So it raises the question, going back to your point before though. So does this make a difference? Does this change public opinion in such a way that if in fact these Republicans, even the ones who vote not guilty, come out and say, yeah, this conduct was bad, is that enough to basically put an end to Donald Trump's viability politically? And I guess I'm also thinking, like, what else is going to happen? Will there be grand jury investigations? Will there be 9/11 style commissions? What happens with the trial, with the investigation down in Atlanta, Georgia, which is ongoing? Will there be civil lawsuits? Because there's a lot there. And I just don't think that this is the end, because you have these ongoing criminal trials of the people. So this is going to have a much longer tail than I think the Ukraine impeachment did. So give me your sense, though. Was this enough to change public opinion and the trajectory of Trump's political future?
So first of all, the only time Trump like gained popularity from a neutral spot during his presidency was during the first impeachment trial. Like people didn't like that in part because people didn't quite understand it. It got lost in a lot of sort of, you know, executive power mumbo jumbo that like we, you know, a lot of people in our world understood it. I think the press was obsessed with it. But you know, like even like the TV ratings didn't bear out that the American public was, let alone the polls. This, as I said before, much more visceral, much more simple. Whether the conviction is there or not, the riot is forever associated with Donald Trump. Now, I'm not going to go so far as Karl Rove said yesterday, I believe, which is that he can't run again because he's already too tarnished. We don't know. Like, I think the important thing, and I wrote about this in the Vanity Fair piece, is time. It's a variety of things. It's not just this. It's that he has been functionally deplatformed from Twitter in particular, which cannot be understated how powerful that is. Donald Trump was on Twitter, I think, going back to like 2008. Now, without this impeachment trial, was already kind of like, we might disagree on this, I think he was already kind of fading from our attention. And I live out in California where things aren't as followed closely here, but like COVID and vaccines feel much more at the front of the public mind. Two, there's what you said, which is we don't know what's going to come next. Like, what does the Attorney General of New York have on Donald Trump? What are they doing to investigate Donald Trump in New York City financial crimes? What do the feds have anything? Anyway, if Donald Trump is to be sullied enough to not run again, we still have to see what the next couple of years will hold. I do think Donald Trump will enjoy maybe playing in the Virginia governor's race in November and certainly the midterms next year, trying to fly in and make endorsements in primaries and that sort of thing. But again, I just think Trump broke a lot of rules, but one of the rules of politics is that I think both parties rarely kind of look back. I mean, I think people want someone new and different. That doesn't mean that like Mitt Romney is going to be the nominee or the party is going to go back to the way it was, but it's what I said earlier, like someone is, I think, going to come along that will capture the attention of Republican voters, the media, who isn't as damaged and perhaps legally threatened as this guy who, you know, and that person should make the argument if they do end up running against Trump. When this person was president, you lost the White House, you know, you lost the Senate, and you never had the House, and you were the left office, the least popular president in modern times. He barely made it. It was George W. Bush, but Trump came out at the end just like Bush. So, you know, that's a compelling argument, I think.
Yeah, you would think so. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to talk to you was, you got a very deep dive, long article in Vanity Fair, comparing Sarah Palin and Donald Trump, and you correct me if I'm getting the thesis wrong, just reminding people what a big deal Sarah Palin was. Now, everybody thought that Sarah Palin was inevitable, that she would sweep everything before her and all the analysis and everything, but she just faded and fizzled. And you suggest that that may be Donald Trump's fate. Is that a fair statement of
your thesis? Yeah. So I think the biggest affliction of the political media is an obsession with the present, with what's happening right now. CNN has a banner up on TV every 30 seconds that says happening now. When you are so stuck in the moment, you forget to lift your head up, look around, understand that things change, politics is complicated, that most people aren't following this stuff day in and day out. So there's that. Two, Sarah Palin was really the first national political figure candidate to fuse grievance politics with, you know, white cultural identity and pure celebrity. Those three things combined made her very powerful and made her attentional powers overwhelming, to the point where, as I mentioned in the piece, she, every time her face appeared on Fox News or MSNBC, ratings jumped 15% just by being on TV. You know, Andrea Mitchell did her MSNBC show from a Barnes & Noble in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where Palin was doing a book tour. She was like on Fox. She was everywhere. People forget how in your face and always on Sarah Palin was, not just in 2008, but from 2008 all the way until the Iowa State Fair in 2011. She was threatening to run for president back then, and Steve Bannon was pulling some strings for her at that point. She really was inescapable. New York Magazine put her on the cover of the magazines, calling it, like, you know, the Sarah Palin industry, and Barbara Walters and Katie Couric, and everyone wanted a piece. And it wasn't just, I got in a fight with someone on Twitter the other day. They were like, well, you know, the first person was really Newt Gingrich, and someone else, well, the first person was really Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. They weren't on Entertainment Tonight. They weren't on Access Hollywood. They weren't on the cover of Us Weekly. Like, she was bigger than politics in a way. She was an international celebrity in a way that Donald Trump is, and in a way that Donald Trump leveraged on his way to the White House and in the White House. And so all of that being said, the parallels are obvious enough. I think she broke open the door for Trump. Is that, you know, without social media, like, his media environment looks a lot more like 2009, 10, 11 than it does 2021. And he's really more codependent on media attention than he was before he was deplatformed. And when you're not at the front of the public mind, when you were deprived of power, you know, public attitudes change, attention shifts. And this is a very boring, maybe obvious argument, but like the passage of time is very powerful.
It's a good, well, let me tell you a story that actually reinforces your point here, because I remember, and I'm pretty sure it was in late 2009, Sarah Palin came to Wisconsin, and she was a speaker for an event for Wisconsin Right to Life. And the turnout was so huge, they had to move it into one of the big barns at the Wisconsin State Fair out in West Dallas. And I was the master of ceremonies. I had to introduce her. And so I was sitting on stage, sitting right behind her when she was speaking. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, if she runs, and I already was becoming quite skeptical, but I was there, thinking this woman would just sweep the primaries before her. There's no way that a Mitt Romney would be able to compete with her because she had that celebrity. She had that charisma. The grassroots was there for her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I was one of those that thought, oh, my God, this is the woman. And of course, I thought it would be dangerous because I didn't think she was qualified, but I did think she was inevitable. So then fast forward to the next time that she's in West Dallas that I was aware of, which is right before the Wisconsin primary in 2016. She gave what is universally regarded as the worst political speech anyone had ever heard. In fact, it was so bad that the most relevant debate was drugs, stroke, something, what the hell happened to her? Clearly not the person that she was earlier, or maybe this is the same person without the speechwriters. I still don't know the answer to all of that. But let me just say that the two objections to your piece that I've heard, okay, it would be the comparison why Trump is not going to be Palin, is number one, Palin was never president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Okay, so she never had that. And the second is that Trump has had, we're now 10 years later, mm-hmm. and that we've basically had the crazification of the Republican base has advanced for that 10 years, that in fact the fever swamps are much broader and deeper than they were for her. She was certainly a product of all of that, but it wasn't as dominant as it is right now. So you have all of the things that Sarah Palin had going for her. You have the presidency, and you have the fact that the Republican base, you know, maybe the crazy was still a recessive gene back in 2009, 2010, 2011. It is certainly a dominant gene now.
Yeah, and those are both like fair, strong objections. I just, and is the flip side of the president argument is what we just talked about. It's like, yeah, he was president and that makes him more inescapable and more credible in a way. It also brings a ton, it exposes what he did for better or worse, and it exposes him to a legal threat. So there's that.
Yeah.
Two, yeah, the internet environment has changed significantly. I mean, the conservative media that rallied to Sarah Palin's defense back then was, you know, like bloggers. It was like Red mm-hmm. State, things like that, or, you know, Matthew Continetti and the Weekly Standard. I mean, the organs that we now think of today as almost never Trump organs were then, like, in a lot of ways, pro Palin. Now it's like, first, like social media, these platforms have let their, you know, platforms and audiences grow uncontrollably and without regulation. And that's created like its whole and a whole other set
yeah.
of problems. However, the point of the piece was just to sort of like put out an argument against the Trump 2024 absolutism that followed election day. I remember,
sure.
you know, on election week, during election week, you know, that was the dominant thing on the dominant take on Twitter among, you know, a lot of Republicans and a lot of reporters was like, well, whatever, Trump can run again. Trump's going to run. Trump's absolutely going to be the most powerful person mm-hmm. in the Republican Party. Maybe, but like, maybe not, you know, like we just don't know, like the future.
Right.
And this goes back to my gripe with the media's obsession with right now being forever. We just don't know. Like when Trump lost the election, we didn't know that Twitter would literally cut off both of his arms a few days later.
Okay, like, can we just stop with that? I am amazed at how effective the Twitter ban has been on him. I really, in you know, before that happened, you know, people said we should, you know, he should be kicked off of Twitter. And I think my knee-jerk reaction was, yeah, well, that's not going to stop him. I mean, that's not going to change. He'll just find some other way of expressing himself. But it's been really amazing the degree to
yeah.
which it has lowered his profile. Are you surprised by that, about how dramatic the, you know, the post-Twitter Trump world has been?
I am surprised. Like, just my own mindshare being deprived of Trump every day is there. And like, I am not one of these people who like obsessively followed every one of his tweets, you know, that, partly because that wasn't my job and I was relieved that I didn't have to. But I was also in the camp where I was a little bit like Tim Miller in that I had the idea that it's a difficult call. And I say this as someone who like works at a tech platform that's larger than Twitter, to remove a world leader from the platform. Like that's tough, but it happened. And I thought what was going to happen was Twitter had already made kind of apparent that once Trump was no longer president, as a policy, if he violated their terms of service, if he violated their policies around hate speech, violence, etc., they would remove him. So I was sort of thinking that was going to happen eventually, that he would just violate
terms
of service and get kicked off or banned or whatever. I am surprised that Twitter just kind of went ahead and did it. It reveals, for better or worse, that the executives at tech companies wield a ton of power and can make just individual decisions overnight. That can't be underestimated. It also reveals that Facebook is rather toothless in that respect. Mark Zuckerberg could do a lot of things that he isn't doing. It's just like, oh, wow, Trump isn't in our face all the time, every day. And it's just it makes the last 4 years feel, you know, just like a very difficult relationship. And you like come up for air and you're like, oh, wow.
it feels like time is elongating itself. That now it's not, I mean, like, for example, this morning when I was reading about Nikki Haley, I had this instinct, which was like, well, wait till Trump tweets about this. The tweets are coming. And they were, no, they're not. There will be no. We actually can think about this for a couple of hours. We can actually, maybe there'll be a news cycle where we can discuss this before we have to, you know, be inundated by another, you know, rage tweet storm.
Yeah, they're even when reporters and news organizations made the decision, we don't have to cover every single thing Trump tweets, like it didn't matter. Like they aren't the decision makers. Like Trump injected himself into the public consciousness with a single tweet, no matter what. Now, yeah, he's just like, say it's 2022 and he's flying to, you know, Florida to endorse in the Senate race. Like that'll be a story, but like it's mostly dependent on the news media showing up and covering it and writing about it and talking about it. And then like, after that, it's just not as much of a thing.
That's the other thing that I guess, going back to the impeachment just for a moment, if Republicans ever wanted an off-ramp, this is so perfect for them because, first of all, the case is so overwhelming, but also they have nothing to lose from this. I mean, they don't have to worry about his tweets anymore, but they might worry about him, you know, in the future, you know, coming out against them in a primary. But also, he can't do anything for them anymore. He can't you know, appoint any judges or cut any taxes or do anything. That there's no political downside to it. And of course, they're sitting there watching what is one of the worst defenses ever. While you and I were talking, I just briefly looked over my shoulder to look at Twitter because while we are speaking, for people who are going to be listening to this over the weekend, the Trump lawyers are making their presentation. I see Philip Bump from the Washington Post saying, this is even worse than I expected. I mean, the whataboutism, the montages of Democrats saying fight, relitigating the Charlottesville thing. I mean, it is apparently a complete clusterfuck. But again, it won't matter because, to paraphrase our colleague Sarah Longwell, these lawyers, you know, woke up this morning knowing that they could walk into the Senate chamber and basically just stand there with their middle fingers raised and say, suck it, bitches. And they'll win the case, right? I mean, the Republicans are still going to vote to acquit, but it is they're certainly not making it any easier for these Republicans that are just going to have to put their heads down and go, okay, shit, we got to do that. We have to eat the sandwich again.
Yeah, I think, and the other point is that Trump like didn't really have a legal team until like the week before. So like these guys are just sort of coming in without doing homework and riffing. I mean, the first opening arguments from what's his name, Bruce Castor, were just so atrocious. Someone, I saw a tweet that was like, that's like you get called on in your like Zoom class and like you don't know what to talk about, like talk about the Constitution.
I have nightmares like that, you know. Yeah. You're pushed out on stage.
But do you think a long-term consequence of this is like if there's no compelling defense of Trump and it just boils down to like unprepared whataboutism, you know, it's not just like, LOL, nothing matters. Ha ha. They'll win. I mean, like, this is a minority political strategy. There just aren't. I know Trump got 74 million votes. Mm-hmm. I know he can win again. And I know the party is forever broken. At the same time, like, as a means of obtaining power in this country, like, it's just not a majority way of thinking in any way. And I know that there are institutions. I know that there's the Electoral College. I know that there's gerrymandering. And I know that the conservative media bubble is very powerful. But like, it is, to me, it doesn't strike me as sustainable in a way that will allow Republicans to gain or keep power. I think Mitch McConnell believes that. And, you know, I think that a lot of powerful Republicans and donors believe that. And this, just to bring the conversation back around, like, if someone wants to be a Republican president again, I just don't think the path to power is imitating Donald Trump plainly. There has to be some kind of added charisma, wrinkle,
something,
change in tone. Whataboutism gets a lot of attention in a relatively small cocoon of Americans. And I just don't think Republicans can win by just continuing on that way.
Okay, so two last, very briefly in the time we have left, just two other non-Trumpian points here that I know that you've commented on, but I feel the need to bring it up. The bursting of the Andrew Cuomo bubble. The stories that we're now hearing about the possible cover up about the number of COVID positive cases that were transferred into nursing homes. Juxtaposed with the media love affair with Andrew Cuomo. I mean, he went out and he had a book, and did he get an Emmy or something like that? The Andrew Cuomo luster is, speaking of lusters fading, have we reached the expiration date on Andrew Cuomo as America's governor?
You know, we had to endure that for almost a year. People forget, first of all, like, this exposes the fallacy of letting your politics get in the way of science, data, facts, and your beliefs about COVID. I mean, I am not a fan of shut-in New Yorkers, you know, mask-shaming people on Twitter and, like, pointing fingers at Florida and red states. Like, there's a lot about COVID and how it spreads that we don't know. And as a consequence of that, policy responses at the state level, like, aren't inherently good or bad. And what we need a lot of time to look back and determine what worked. The Cuomo thing is remarkable because there were a lot of Democratic governors, because of what I just mentioned, who were held up at the beginning of COVID because they weren't Donald Trump. Gavin Newsom, Jay Inslee, actually a good one. And Cuomo. The Cuomo thing was ridiculous because Cuomo, in a lot of ways, is like a mini Trump. Like, he berates the media. He's secretive. He's kind of a weirdo. If you've ever covered him up close, like, not Mr. Charisma. And he, because of his relationship with his brother on CNN and CNN's like new devotion to being talk radio in primetime, like, it was just silly. Like, it was just entertainment. It was fluff. And it resistance liberals flocked to him because he wasn't Donald Trump. He had these briefings, which were much more rooted in facts and numbers. But, you know, if you hold up a politician like as a doctor, like, it's just inevitably going to get exposed. And his own state attorney general has revealed that they undercounted the number of nursing home deaths. You know, investigation that came out on Thursday revealed that there were more people readmitted to nursing homes who had COVID from hospitals than previously. Yeah. Like, and again, this is where Cuomo is like Trump again, like, refuses to acknowledge mistakes, refuses to say, I'm sorry, blames somebody else. It's never his fault. Like, the fact that progressives and liberals held this guy up as a, you know, the patron saint of like stopping COVID is ridiculous.
Speaking of falling from grace, might as well mention this, the Lincoln Project, Steve Schmidt, the subject of this deep dive AP report, and I think also the New York Magazine about the sexual harassment charges against John Weaver, which he's basically acknowledged, and raising questions about leadership and about what they knew and when they knew it and where the money went. This is another one of those stories where, and I got to say, this one's tough because, unfortunately, I think a lot of people in the Never Trump movement are going to be tarnished with all of that. We're not part of that at all, but we were allied. We were in the foxhole, and and wow, it certainly feels like they're in crisis at the moment.
One of the founders of Lincoln Project, Rick Wilson, wrote a book, I think, or had a saying that like everything Trump touches dies. The Lincoln Project is sort of part of that now. I mean, they, because they chose to do battle with him on his terms on Twitter with like very slashing personal attacks, you know, they're a little bit like Icarus. And the problems I had with the Lincoln Project weren't necessarily about the fact that they were making a lot of money off of resistance moms who like their ads. And you know, the Weaver stuff is terrible. And as a side note, like it's a lot of people in Republican politics kind of had heard whispers about John Weaver and this stuff for a very long time. So it's very difficult to imagine that Steve Schmidt, who has worked at the highest levels of Republican politics, including alongside Weaver at times, didn't know about these things. I wrote a piece for Vanity Fair last year about a couple of Democratic groups who were doing testing around persuasion advertising, which has really never been tested in politics. And they ran a bunch of experiments seeing which messages actually changed minds, which advertisements actually changed minds. And the kinds of ads that directly attack Donald Trump, calling him names, associating him with Putin, making fun of his weight, making fun of his health, actually caused a ton of backlash. In other words, they drove people into their corners. If you were already convinced that you hate Donald Trump, you gave money to the Lincoln Project. But if you were an on the fence Republican voter or like a persuadable voter, you know, maybe you went to church, whatever, those ads really drove you back in your corner. And the Lincoln Project essentially became associated with, you know, another one of Trump's enemies like CNN or the New York Times. So like if you saw one of their ads and you were a like on the fence voter in Florida, chances are you went screaming in the other direction. Not to mention the fact that Democrats, the voters they needed too, were kind of low information voters, people of color who weren't on Twitter and seeing these ads in the first place. The kinds of ads that did work, frankly, were the Republican voters against Trump ads, where you saw first person testimonials from Republicans that look like me recorded on cell phone video, sort of low grade production value. That stuff actually really works. So, you know, not only does the Lincoln Project have a ton of challenges, it's hard to see them actually lasting now, even though they've made millions of dollars and all purchased new homes off of this group. But, you know, I haven't seen a reasonable case that their ads actually change a lot of minds. And that's
that's unfortunate. Yeah. That is unfortunate. You know, there's a certain just the ads that make certain people feel good about it. But they did some good stuff. But I do think that there's that moment where we all jumped the shark. But and maybe the fact that they did engage Trump on his in his own terms, that there's some weird dynamic where they became what they hated. Including in terms of the way they handled the money. It's very interesting watching George Conway, who's broken very badly against them. In fact, he was the one who called him out for potentially illegally screenshotting Jennifer Horne's social media. He had a tweet saying this is a violation of federal law. You need to take it down. And he's pounded them. I see that our good friend Tom Nichols has stepped down as an unpaid advisor to the group. So you kind of have a feeling that people are backing away. And I don't think this story is over, so I don't want to prejudge at all. Yeah. But I do think that Steve Schmidt has a lot of explaining to do, and I think there's going to be a lot more accountability. Peter Hamby, thank you so much. This has been absolutely delightful. This is the first time you've been on the podcast, and I appreciate your time very, very much.
Bring me back, Charlie. I love it. Thank you for talking.
We will. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.